And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Okay, welcome. This is the Three Left Show, live in the studio at WCAA LP Albany, New York. With me in the studio is my most progressive co-host, Mike Walsh.
Hello.
So this show is, we're going in a different direction. I don't know why I said that again. But we represent the three lefts that are socialism, anarchism, and ecology. We discuss radical left-wing politics for a post-capitalist future. Whether you think capitalism is markets or just the control of all wealth by a very few or managers, we can talk about that as well. Very loose in our definitions, multifaceted, multi-tendency, non-dogmatic discussion in politics. So this episode, the topic is anti-colonialism or decolonization, looking at issues from a indigenous perspective. We are not First Nation indigenous, whatever term you prefer, ourselves. We are Jewish white guys.
Yep.
But we are going to read the words of such people and share them with you, because otherwise they don't get shared enough. And they are very important to understanding the crisis we are in and how to think about it. But first, some jibber jabber of current events.
So Kamala Harris happened, and I called it
again
months ago. Like I knew that he was gonna pick her. Like,
there's no other choice. She was already exactly. Climbing. She's climbed the Democratic Party ladder. It's her turn.
I posted a good meme about it, and it was the Hannibal Buress meme where he's like, "Why are you booing me? I'm right." And it was Joe Biden saying, "Why are you booing me about her? She's black."
Yes, and what's truly rustling my jimmies is that you have this, you know, progressives discussing their feelings on her, but as far as their politics are concerned, they're going to vote for the ticket anyway.
Right.
So why is this even a debate or discussion amongst them? Unless it's still in the context of, are we leaving the Democratic Party or not?
Right.
We've been slighted for the 10th time in my lifetime, or, you know, as long as I've been active in politics. That's why it disturbs me to see people that I know, this is not their first rodeo, not the first election cycle they've lived through, or the third. And they're having the same conversations about whether or not the Democratic Party is like a vehicle for them. But they've just accepted the ideology that it's the only game in town.
Right.
And there's no alternative. There's no reason or ability to build an alternative, which is where the true hopelessness and defeat lies.
Right.
And knowing that you can't even try. There's no point in trying. You have to burn. If you do that, you have to acknowledge revolutionary perspectives, the burn it down, or the we need to transform everything, social revolution, and that might get messy,
right.
Undisciplined, because we're not organized yet. And I'm not going to do the organization, organizing people like mind and change people's minds towards that direction.
Exactly.
They can't do it for themselves. We attempt to do that for others. Because actually, it was via the Real News Network, so I'm not going to. I'll link that in on Three Left's Facebook page. Just their coverage, an interview with someone who's props to the social sciences. We need more social sciences, because when it comes to political discussions, there is a lack of actual sociology being this kind of inserted. So he, in red counties, Trump voting counties, they simply canvassed, not and mostly out of a context of not for an during an election, not with a candidate or a platform, just canvassed and asked questions slash had conversations around topics of, well, first asking people what they cared about, then asking about immigration, and then kind of following up with them. And so canvassing twice, like, would you like to talk more? Because a lot of them were thirsty to talk to people. No one's ever canvassed them because these are rural areas. So I'm not even sure how they're, I guess they just devote because it's their job. I mean, the grant pays for it, let's say. They can drive house to house and spend a month doing this. Because otherwise, in a campaign cycle, you don't have the resources to do it. Urban areas, it's a slog, but at least everyone lives close. You can go door to door within a minute. But in rural areas, it could take you 5 minutes just to drive from house to house. But to do so is to actually reach out to the people who you might consider hopeless, deplorable, whatever, which is just classist and not constructive at all. Because they found that they could change their minds on many things. Because as soon as they started talking to people in their area, by the way, about what they're really afraid of or what their real concerns are, which are healthcare, economy, and then, you know, immigration, but like immigration because like they're seeing them as competitors and enemies. That can be changed because as soon as a different perspective is introduced, they're not going, even once or twice, they're not going to watch Fox News the same way again. And this makes total sense to me. It's how I kind of, we all break the conditioning. As soon as we start like hear a radical, let's say, perspective like ours once, you're not going to listen to Democracy Now! Or NPR the same way again.
No.
I mean, maybe not completely the same way or you know, not completely different, of course, but a little bit different each time, especially if you go back and forth.
I have a similar perspective. I used to watch The Hill with Crystal Ball.
Crystal Ball and Sagar.
Like, a lot. And then recently, Vosh did a talked about them and talked about how...
For a few hours.
It's Crystal Ball is helping the fascists and how the populist right are fascists and how Crystal Ball is complicit in their indoctrination and trying to get former disillusioned Bernie people to hop on to the Trump train. And it's been hard to watch The Hill ever since.
Well, meanwhile, I'm finding it hard to listen to Vosh because he does the opposite of, not the opposite, but the same coin of convincing his audience to vote for Biden and continue Democratic Party politics.
That's the big thing.
His style, by the way, for those listening, his style is to be as uncharitable as possible, to be as aggressive and confident as possible, because he's all about a type of optics of strength, as he puts it, where you are basically doing the Trump thing almost, but just speaking eloquently.
Right.
Where you're just so confident about what you're talking about, even though, and this is what kind of infuriates me about him, even though I do enjoy listening to him time to time, I'm doing so less now than a year ago. Because, see, he's good at debating the right. He's part of the left-tuber streamer kind of community slash group that is making a living out of debating and doing blood sports online. And so he's good at debating the right, making them look bad, and then getting people to move to the center or left-leaning. But that's his mission, and that's his job. But then as soon as he starts talking about what people should do once they're on the left, he needs to shut up, to be quite frank. If I was on his stream, I would be just as mean as he is at times and say, like, you don't know what you're talking about. Have you ever done any activism? Have you ever done any organizing? Have you canvassed a neighborhood before? Have you talked to people in public who aren't through a chat room where it's all spammy and stuff? It's a totally different context. Don't talk about how you know how politics works. Because you haven't interacted with Seattle government or something. Like, you just haven't. You're looking at things through, when it comes to policy, as through the abstract lens of reading policy papers. So when, you know, so it's something different when to all of the people in the stream who are just alt-right to listen to Bernie's platform. But what I don't like is when he says, this is the most radical platform I've ever read. Because he has to make everything bombastic and exciting for his audience.
That's true.
So hopefully, you know, a lot of that audience can then transfer to leftist discussion groups and podcasts like ours for when the bombacity of Vosh becomes a little less entertaining. It's like, okay, I don't need to watch him bash right-wingers over and over again, because then he quickly bashes left-wingers just as easily in the same way.
Yeah, that is true.
There was a discussion group on one of the Facebook threads where I think it was the Sincere group again. Someone just kind of made an anti-Vosh post. Not saying like he's all trash, but just that he had a trash take.
Yeah.
Particularly like a video that stirred discussion because it was shorter. 15 minutes is more watchable.
Yeah.
And it was like, why the left addicted to losing? And
it's a picture of Bernie.
So I haven't listened to it. I don't care to. I know what he's good. You know what he's saying.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's probably not going to be the conclusion I would want him to make to his audience. Because sometimes it sounds like he's getting there, but then he'll just go right back to like, Bernie or Busters are the most degenerate, stupid, you know, unrealistic, irrational, like, you know, all these people. Because he's online and those are the people that are showing up.
Right.
Not Green Party, third party people. They're not showing up. So he doesn't interact with them. So it's like these other movements, these other options don't exist.
Yeah.
That hurts a bit, especially when like, you know, maybe I'm jumping around, waving my arms, but I'm in the back of the crowd kind of feeling.
Right.
I'm not going to be invited on the talk, because when he does talk to other lefties or something, they're also inexperienced organizers or just starting out.
Right.
And it's interesting because he's not that much younger than me. But yeah, and he also says he's on the spectrum, so he doesn't read well. But it's like reading things is all he does. So he's super prepared when it comes to his debates and whatever he's doing, whatever is right in front of him. So I'm not just talking about one guy. I'm talking about like whole sections of society here. But he's really ignorant about everything else.
Yeah.
Like something about geopolitics will be brought up and he's like, oh, I don't care about that. You know, and he has to like shirk it off like he doesn't care, because that's his macho like personality. Say like, I don't know that. I'm open to learning more.
I consider him kind of like keeping up with the Kardashians, but for leftists. So it's like, it's not too much substance, but it's like kind of nice to just sit back and turn your brain off and just have a leftist perspective, especially when he's bashing right wingers.
So I would, and Vosh is more like bombastic, but you have the Serfs that does the same purpose, but without the I know what I'm talking about when it comes to leftist strategy.
I actually recently saw a conversation between Vosh and the Serfs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think I listened to that one in particular, but I'm sure it was chummy, and that's fine. Lance, the Serf guy, he's Canadian, and you know it. I was just turned off by like third party politics or independent politics, even.
Yeah.
It was always a constant debate or struggle about like, or the argument for working within the system.
Yeah.
Which is always going to be the knife is 5 inches in, let's pull it out 1 inch.
Yeah.
Which is Kamala Harris in a nutshell. When progressives are discussing how progressive she is. And thus I can segue into how that word is meaningless. I'll give you some context. So when a word is used as a stand-in for a lot of other things that either the speaker does not actually want to identify, or if to attribute a negative intent, if it's just ignorance or unintentional, then it's they don't know what they could be talking about. So like
the word socialist
or social democrat in the case of people who identify as progressive.
Right.
They should be identifying, I'm saying should in an objective way, should be saying they're social democrats.
Yeah.
That's their politics. Agree with that. But instead, because that phrase is unknown to the American public, they have to use progressive.
Yeah.
At least that's if it's intentional. But then to the people, the masses, they hear progressive as a stand-in for all of these policy and positions. And so they're going to use it as the identifier. So, but they don't know that it's referring to social democrat. Maybe the first speaker does, but not everyone that he's repeating it to.
Right.
So it's a form of marketing, and marketing is always part lie. I think it would be more honest to talk about social democracy, democratic socialism, and socialist, and what are the differences policy-wise of these terms.
Oh, yeah.
That would solve some optics problems.
Oh, definitely.
And progressives are not helping because they constantly use this word. And then it's an argument of what does progressive mean? And is this person progressive enough for like the standards of what qualifies as a progressive are thus undefinable.
Well, when I first came to the left,
in the way Jordan Peterson would like call out,
it was kind of hard to like try to de-learn like the phrases and references that I had before and understand the new terminology of like, say, how Marxist-Leninists are different from Trotskyists and how all of the different
tendencies
within leftism are different from each other, and how the right kind of just puts the blanket commie on everything and goes, oh yeah, let's yeet them from the helicopters because they're all commies.
Mm-hmm.
And God, that's so stupid.
Of course it is. So when I ran for mayor, and it was really just an excuse. So I wasn't, since I didn't have a social studies grant, I did in fact need, maybe in my mind, maybe it's a bias, probably is, that I need an excuse to go out and canvass people and okay. have those conversations that move people one way or the other, but I'm not following up. I'm not doing it in a scientific manner.
Okay? Right.
Because I'm not a social scientist. Sue me. But I went around and canvassed at least 1,000 doors.
Oh, wow.
I did have a full count, more or less. But block-wise, it was like 50 blocks in various parts of the city, mostly in three neighborhoods. You could say I canvassed three neighborhoods. And it was every house. I wasn't doing it with a list, so I wasn't taking contacts down. I wasn't doing things in the organizing kind of way.
Right.
Bad organizing as far as that's concerned. But as far as like, I'm just going to talk to people, no pressure.
Yeah.
To take their name and or phone number and whatever and email. So they would feel more comfortable. My opinion was they would feel more comfortable and open to talking if I didn't ask them for anything.
Right.
Except their time. Which they were also, many people gave willingly.
Yeah.
Didn't have to be cajoled. They were interested in talking. And I had a lot of great conversations and I made notes and how amenable and friendly they were to, you know, I'm running for office. How do you feel about that? You know, this is only somebody you might support. So there was that in there as well as, so it's more, that was the follow up of like, okay, we've had this conversation. How do you feel about the things on my leaflet here? That included community controlled police and the things that are maybe getting some press now.
Right.
This was back, this was 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. So during that race was you had the Democratic primary and it was an argument of who was more progressive.
Yeah. Because
this is the voter base is split between kind of conservative and progressive wings. But for the most part, the current mayor was elected with a base of progressives. Progressive support is kind of what is needed to win. So you had Democrats, three different Democrats. You could even say like one. Nah. But there were different kinds of types of Democrats. One was like Old Boys Club, and one is technocrat, and the other is kind of a black woman who's from an organizing / helping her people background.
Yeah.
And they were all arguing about, the meta argument was who was more progressive.
Right.
And then the discussion that I would input on was, what does it mean to be progressive? Couldn't be defined. I don't think there was any progress made in that, like there was no conclusion that could
right.
be drawn. Because people were not really able to talk about policies because they were really similar. It was really just their attitudes towards things
yeah.
and the fact that they were opponents.
Yep.
And that's what kind of nonpartisan politics devolves into eventually, where everyone's really just on the side of the person they personally like.
Yeah.
And then it's not about the policy anymore. It's not about what the results are. It's just whether or not like you're satisfied with the way things are going or are problems being solved in your block and,
right.
and what upsets you. And, you know, some people just are looking for excuses to be upset or say like how a right winger will always, whatever the headline is, they will look for a way of saying this is a waste of money.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example from the local socialist page that was shared. So DEC. Conservation Department in New York.
Okay.
They have announced a new regulation government regulation limiting the definning of sharks in our waters.
Okay.
So limits on shark fishing and shark protection. And all not right. And shark finning meaning like you just cut the fin off the shark and you don't actually take the whole shark out of the water.
Disgusting.
So you're killing the shark, but you're just taking the fin.
Right.
Because it's a delicacy of Chinese weddings and whatnot.
Of course
or
it is.
Asian weddings. And the guy was like, what a waste of money. You know, like we don't have what body of water in New York has sharks?
We border the ocean.
Yes. And the DEC actually Twitter responded like the Atlantic Ocean. particularly the Long Island Sound, which has an ample commercial fishing opportunities. I actually went on a cruise once that was a fishing cruise. It was a boat that just goes out into the sound, literally, so like old men could fish, and boom, like big 6 foot long fish is like brought up, and it's, you know,
yeah, that's cool.
Pretty impressive for a few rods, but you can have some big heavy duty ones too. Yeah, and my grandfather, rest in peace, also caught like a nice 4 foot something, and he deboned it as soon as we got home. So good. Got through all of that. Is there any other kind of random topic?
I wanted to briefly mention the tragedy that happened that right wingers are twisting into their newest race conflict.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was a innocent little boy that was murdered. That's a tragedy.
He's so cute.
He was cute. And the black man who did it was promptly arrested, charged, and the family of the kid was served justice on a silver platter. And the right wingers are like, the media's ignoring this. We gotta spread the word and raise awareness of this filthy animal and what he did to this precious white child. It's like...
any black-on-white crime in particular.
Exactly. And it's like...
that's what exists for them.
So I have a good meme that I found for it, and it was like, what about this boy who was killed? Where are the protests for him? And someone's like, did they catch the guy who did it? Yes.
The police, because we are talking about police.
Did they arrest and charge him? Immediately. Is he going to jail? Forever. So why would we need to protest? And then the guy's like, oh, because that's why the protest happened, because justice hasn't been served and needs to be served. That's when we protest.
Well, I would, just to, because I'm good at empathizing with other positions, to know where they're coming from with this, they wouldn't say, no, there is a reason to protest. The fact that this black man had the ability to kill the child at all. So thus, gun laws? No, not that. We just need to genocide black people or keep them in their place, in their ghettos and whatever, contained, which is then like another meme was just like, I just don't want black people.
Oh, yeah. Here's another good one. It's, you know, I'm outraged. This young white boy was killed by a black man for no reason. The media isn't covering it, and we should all demand justice. They immediately went on a statewide manhunt, found him within 24 hours, charged him with first-degree murder, and denied him bail. I don't want justice. I want black people to shut up about being murdered by police. And
pretty much,
yeah, that's kind of,
it would just be put in the terms I just put, where it's like, it's concern about crime, law and order, which is always kind of like, it's not, when I say that, like, I don't care about law and order as a motto, it doesn't mean that the left does not care about order. Of course, that's the big charge about communists, that we care about order so much we make everything tyrannous.
Right.
What I mean is that your order, which is completely unequal, race-based, class-based, you know, and so on, different types of order, you know, there's different types. There's the order of that nature has, which is completely always ignored because natural orders are cyclical and have a, in process that's followed, which capitalist processes do not mirror at all. So... but to pivot back to elections, since we'll start with that first and get it out of the way. And so we'll be bookending our Indigenous perspective section with the same writer here. It is simply, and I've covered this in the past with my, like, you know, anarchist perspectives of electioneering about a whole year ago. Voting is not harm reduction, an indigenous perspective. So a common argument or arm twisting slash rationalization of voting for the Democratic ticket, an election that will have such voter suppression, I'm curious as to why. Well, okay, so you're aware that, you know, the threat of not recognizing the election, which is killing democracy,
right,
is something Republicans have done, or particularly Trump.
Yeah.
And in the act of not recognizing the election seems to be what kills the democracy, not subverting the election or making the election completely worthless as far as a barometer of public will, which Democrats do not seem to, well, they don't like it, but they don't know what to do about it either. And so what they could do is when the election happens and the voter suppression is complete, or rather just as it is currently, even during the primary, which they see that this is why I know what's that the reaction is going to be do nothing. Because in the primary, the same voter suppression that Trump has been instituting happened. I'm not, you know, I don't make statements like this is why Bernie lost.
Right.
But just to recognize that there was vast voter suppression. The same process of closing polling stations across the board, not allowing mass voting, mail voting. This is something the Democratic primary is guilty of.
Yeah.
This is why there are not any kind of savior or harm reduction.
No.
In this case, the act to take after the election is to not publicly not recognize it. To say, when Trump wins, he's not winner. The election system failed. We didn't have a proper election. There's no standard to use except the fact that there was a voting day and the deadline and some ballots were counted, and it's like, that's the standard that Saddam used.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you thought that was tyranny, and we needed to go, and we need to resultantly kill millions of Iraqis to free them, then maybe we need to actually do what other opposition in other countries do, which is say, these elections are illegitimate. We're either A, not going to participate at all, to really show how much of a sham they are, or make it that there is no question that there is a sham. Because if, say, Trump and the government continues with Election Day, even though Democratic Party's committees on the county and state level, let's say this election is not going to, but they're going to keep being complicit. They're going to keep saying, oh, no, we're doing the best we can to have Election Day that's safe and secure and it's a complete show. So that's what I suggest people think about doing. Think about like getting their reps or what have you. Because otherwise, let's see, this was Matt Crispin's point. I like Matt Crispin's streams. It's like listening to Chapo, but without the takes I don't like.
Oh, okay.
So Matt Crispin's my favorite. But he kind of mentioned we're a nation of Karens, at least on Twitter. We're all asking to see the manager because we want problems to be solved, but we don't know who to ask and we can't solve them ourselves.
Yes.
So, but there is no manager. The manager particularly is the president, and we can't ask the manager, or the managers are incompetent.
Yeah.
The managers can't solve the problem. What do you do when the managers can't solve the problem? You leave the store.
Or you get out a guillotine.
Yeah, whatever. But the point is, we're all asking for the manager.
Right.
And because like when people complain about anything online, without the purpose, without a little link to organize under it, you're just complaining to nobody.
Right.
Or you're complaining to us. You think I'm the manager? Well, I guess we're in this together then. We need to organize and be the manager, self-determine our future. So let's put all of that in a different form. Probably say similar things. Voting is not harm reduction, but from an indigenous perspective, a radical one for sure. Published February of this year. So, you know, while the primary was still actually not yet to happen. So it's basically a statement of like, this process is, you know, effed either way. When it's made that voting is harm reduction, it's never clear how less harm is actually calculated. Do we compare how many millions of undocumented immigrant indigenous people have been deported? Do we add up what political party conducted more drone strikes? Or who had the higher military budget? Do we factor in pipelines, mines, dams, sacred sites, desecration? Do we balance incarceration rates? Do we compare sexual violence statistics? Is it in the massive budgets of politicians who spend hundreds of millions of dollars? So the point of these questions is to say that both parties are continuous when it comes to the American United States government.
Though there are some political distinctions between the two prominent parties in the so-called U.S., they all pledge their allegiance to the same flag. Red or blue, they're both still stripes and a rag waving over stolen lands that comprise a country built by stolen lives. We don't dismiss the reality that, on the scale of U.S. settler colonial violence, even the slightest degree of harm can mean life or death for those most vulnerable. What we assert here is that the entire notion of voting as harm reduction obscures and perpetuates the settler colonial violence. There is nothing less harmful about it, and there are more effective ways to intervene in its violence. At some point, the left in the so-called U.S. realized that convincing people to rally behind a lesser evil was a losing strategy. The term harm reduction was appropriated to reframe efforts to justify their participation and coerce others to engage in the theater of what is called democracy in the U.S. Harm reduction was established in the 1980s as a public health strategy for people dealing with substance use issues who struggle with abstinence. According to the Harm Reduction Coalition, HRC, which, side note, that confused the hell out of me when I was reading this article for the first time, because I kept seeing Hillary. HRC and thinking Hillary Rodham Clinton. But the principles of harm reduction establish that the identified behavior is part of life, so they choose not to ignore or condemn, but to minimize harmful effects, and work towards breaking social stigma towards safer use. The HRC also states that there is no universal definition or formula for implementing harm reduction. Overall, harm reduction focuses on reducing adverse impacts associated with harmful behaviors.
Can I interrupt there?
Of course.
In the context of addiction treatment and such, harm reduction is amazingly powerful as a concept.
Right.
Because this is where it's from. And it's also part of acknowledging addiction and, say, toxic behaviors as being conditions.
Right.
To be managed, not cured or gotten rid of.
Right.
So, like, to compare alcoholism to diabetes.
Right.
You're never cured as a diabetic.
No.
But you take the strips, you manage your sugar intake, you get help and advice and, you know, and so on to manage your diabetes.
Right.
Diabetes. And
diabetes.
Thus, may that man rest in peace as well. And so, like, you know, addiction is managed just as, like, when someone is recovering from being an alcoholic, they're always recovering. They're never truly gone because their brain has been rewired so that they could, if they drink alcohol again, spiral down again.
Yeah.
But as long as they're managing their intake, whether it be none or less, that's harm reduction and better than basically drinking to death.
Yeah. So the proposition of harm reduction in the context of voting means something entirely different from those organizing to address substance use issues. The assertion that since this political system isn't going away, we'll support politicians and laws that may do less harm. The idea of a ballot being capable of reducing the harm in a system rooted in colonial domination and exploitation, white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, and capitalism is an extraordinary exaggeration. There is no person whose lives aren't impacted every day by these systems of oppression, but instead in coded reformism and coercive get-out-the-vote campaigns towards safer forms of settler colonialism. We're asking, what is the real and tragic harm and danger associated with perpetuating colonial power, and what can be done to end it? Voting as practiced under U.S. democracy is the process of which people, excluding youth under age of 18, convicted felons, and those the state deems mentally incompetent and undocumented folks, including permanent legal residents, are coerced into choosing narrowly prescribed rules and rulers. The anarchist collective Crime Think observes, voting consolidates the power of a whole society in the hands of a few politicians. When this process is conducted under colonial authority, there is no option but political death for indigenous peoples. In other words, voting can never be a survival strategy under colonial rule. It's a strategy of defeat and victimhood that protracts the suffering and historical harm induced by ongoing settler colonialism. And while the harm reduction sentiment may still be there, or may be sincere, even hard-won marginal reforms gained through popular support can be just as easily reversed by the stroke of a politician's pen. If voting is the democratic participation in our own oppression, voting as harm reduction is a politics that keeps us at the mercy of our oppressors. If voting is the democratic participation... Oh, just re-saying that.
Yeah, line. You know what? There's this is actually a bit longer.
Yeah.
So how about we go down to... I thought I...
Oh, yeah, this is a...
This is a long
thick
one.
Piece.
Okay, how about you skip down to you can decolonize the ballot?
Oh, sure. I actually just scrolled there automatically. Since the idea of U.S. democracy is majority rule bearing an extreme population surge, indigenous voters will always be at the mercy of good-intentioned political allies. Consolidating the native vote into a voting bloc that aligns with whatever settler party, politician, or law that appears to do less harm isn't a strategy to exercise political power. It's Stockholm Syndrome. The native vote also seeks to produce native politicians. And what better way to assimilate rule than with a familiar face? The strategy of voting indigenous peoples into a colonial power structure is not an act of decolonization. It's a fulfillment of it. We have a history of our people being used against us by colonial forces, particularly when assimilated indigenous peoples acting as Indian scouts to aid the enemy's military. In only one recorded instance, Ndi, an Apache army scouts, mutinied against the U.S. when they were asked to fight their own people. Three of the Ndi scouts were executed as a result. No matter what you are led to believe by any politician seeking office, at the end of the day, they are sworn to uphold an oath to the very system that was designed to destroy us in our way of life. The oath for members of Congress states, "I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter, so help me God." Even if we assume that their cultural values and intentions are in line with those of the people, it is rare that politicians are not tied to a string of funders. As soon as they get elected, they are faced with unrelenting special interest lobbying groups that have millions and millions of dollars behind them, and even if they have stated the best intentions, are inevitably outnumbered by their political peers.
I would probably point out that the reason for reading out the whole oath and whatever is to point out that there is no mention of serving people.
No.
Or planet, or making things better in any way. It's simply just an oath that, you know, uphold the Constitution. But what is the Constitution? It's a document written by slave owners to preserve their power in a changing world, their world, which is now long dead. Even with the Bill of Rights and the amendments, which still, again, haven't been updated since the 40s. Were there even an event? No, the last amendment was like in the 30s or something, the 20s. Basically ending prohibition.
All right, I'm going to skip ahead to just after the "I refuse to perpetuate settler colonial domination" sticker, which is in the form of an "I voted" sticker, and I actually kind of like that.
And it has a burning flag on it.
Yeah. Voting will never be harm reduction. While colonial occupation and U.S. imperialism reigns, in order to heal, we have to stop the harm from occurring, not lessen it. This doesn't mean simply abstinence or ignoring the problem until it goes away. It means developing and implementing strategies and maneuvers that empower indigenous peoples' autonomy. Since we cannot expect those selected to rule in this system to make decisions that benefit our lands and our peoples, we have to do it ourselves. Direct action, or the unmediated expression of individual or collective desire, has always been the most effective means by which we change the conditions of our communities. What do we get out of voting that we cannot directly provide for ourselves and our people? What ways can we organize and make decisions that are in harmony with our diverse lifeways? What ways can the immense amount of material resources and energy focused on persuading people to vote be redirected into services and support that we actually need? What ways can we direct our energy, individually and collectively, into efforts that have immediate impact on our lives and the lives of those around us?
This reminds me of how when, this is usually in conversation with liberals, or at least the politically active in the system, when a seat is empty and someone's appointed to it, or a special election needs to be held but it isn't, costs will be brought up.
Yeah.
The cost of holding an election, and how there'll even be a tone of, it's expensive. It's too expensive. I'm like, so you care about democracy. We like this thing, but we won't pay for it.
Right.
We won't pay for it, you know, often enough that it would matter, or and so on. And this is definitely from an anarchist perspective.
Right.
It's pretty obvious, and it repeats points made by anarchists that I've read in the past. And so you can basically self-insert yourself. Whenever the writer says indigenous peoples, just put in even any identity group you are a part of. Even if you identify as white, I think. It's like you could probably put yourself in that position because, hey, you're not in the ruling class.
No.
And do you, if you elect someone with your face, does that mean you have political power? Now, there are plenty of homeowners and whatever who feel this way. They're the people that are riding with Biden.
Right.
But they are a minority of people. They're a minority of voters. Well, rather, they are the voters because only a minority vote. And for president, it's more than that. We're lucky if we get half of the population to vote.
Right.
It's got to be much less this year, mostly because of the suppression and jest that the repetition of the narrative that there's only two choices and that we have to work so hard on our own, mind you.
To even be recognized.
To be recognized as candidates.
Yeah.
That Howie is there. And then usually you always have to get pushback. I mean, not always, but mostly get pushback of like, oh, yeah, but Howie isn't a choice for me. I live in North Dakota.
Right. I don't really have a choice but to bring up the Electoral College when I'm trying to justify my decision to vote for Howie. Like, I have to say that we live in New York, and New York's a blue state, so there's no way my electoral vote's going to Trump, so I feel safe doing that. I hate that I have to justify it that way.
Part of being a, you know, we are separate from the system mentality of, like, we don't justify it.
Right.
We do what we do, because when it comes to the person you're having to justify yourself, they don't care.
Yeah.
Or if you do point out the inconsistency of their position, they get really upset.
Oh, definitely.
Because you're not doing it in a Socratic, nice, general conversational way where they might feel comfortable to maybe dissect their belief system.
Right.
But when Trump derangement system is in there and the fears and the anxieties are bundled in, there is a lot of blocks to that. So you really need to make people super comfortable. And that's where the optics of, like, not talking radical, not having revolutionary politics when you're in public discussing these things. And then I shy away. You know, I didn't mention socialism when I was running for mayor, having all these conversations.
Right.
I didn't use buzzwords.
Right.
Except maybe democracy. But direct democracy was what I was like, autonomy, control of our neighborhoods. I had homeowners that would push back on that being a good thing because they trust managers. You know, they get, when they ask for the management, they get what they want.
Right.
That wasn't the case for everyone I knocked on the doors, especially when it was more working class side of town. I stayed away from the part of town where they're completely alienated, though.
Right.
So I'm not, you know, super organizer here because I know, like, the pushback I would get from even just like attempting, because there just has to be an option in the first place for them to participate, which there isn't. When the pandemic started, the lockdown, the social safety net, not even safety net, but all of the social programs and things, churches that paper over our social issues,
right,
our problems, the crisis, they're all gone. And that's why the crisis is intensifying.
Yeah.
The gun violence is increasing. The fact that, you know, even during summer, what few summer programs there were can't operate. So now you even have more bored teenagers messing with people.
Oh, yeah.
And lacking love and any kind of attention. And they're all going to be little Trumps.
Yeah.
And this is how, like, having a Trump president makes more Trumps is the argument. So we have to get rid of Trump. But quite frankly, it's society as a whole. the fact that, you know, you take away church summer programs or the city's summer program and suddenly there's nothing for teens to do safely or, you know, viably. And this goes for a case that was in the context of criminal justice reform and having a less punitive society and generally abolishing police, prisons, whatever.
Right.
Pushback I get from even very progressive friend of mine, and that, you know, I was arguing with him in a friendly way, helping him out. And he was pointing out, he was just discussing the case of, here in Albany, we had some teens who were shooting at each other and a toddler inside a house was hit.
Oh.
Survived, but hit. He wasn't sent to juvie because of raise the age and bail reform. Oh. And so he was assigned parole.
Okay.
Which is almost nothing.
Yeah.
Especially in practice, parole does nothing. So he wasn't given community service. He wasn't put in any kind of other kind of program. Any kind of socially beneficial thing wasn't done because it would cost money or something. And, or some kind of resource. And so he has murdered someone this year. So it's a case of, from the law and order folks, of, see, you took away punishment and it only led to more harm. Like, yes, but we didn't replace it with anything.
Right.
The argument is always from us, the diversion of funds towards social process of not reward, but certainly stuff. Because stuff is better than nothing. And punishment is not a deterrent. It's simply removing the problem. Just as with tenants, you know, when landlords complain about tenants, so we can finish up the hour with the landlord discussion that we had before the show started. That, you know, when you throw out your trash, you're just moving your mess outside.
Right.
You're not cleaning up after yourself. And this goes for mass amounts of our society, class, race, and whatever don't apply. It's really just a general societal capitalist problem of teaching our children and ourselves to not clean up after ourselves, and those who were raised to, it's indoctrination of its own type to indoctrinate people to clean up after themselves in proper slash ways. And I just don't mean the type of ways that are virtue signaling or feeling good, like by recycling. But to me, like, recycling to me is not an effort to actually like save material and energy. I know it doesn't do that. But it's really just a way of sorting the mess so that the mess is in a different form, a better form than it was if it was all just being dumped.
Right. Not really. Do you want me to finish up the article?
Sure.
This is not only a moral, but a practical position, and so we embrace our contradictions. Mm-hmm. We are not rallying for a perfect prescription for decolonialization or a multitude of indigenous nationalisms, but for a great undoing of the settler colonial project that comprises the United States of America.
Oh, that's scary.
So that we may restore healthy and just relations with Mother Earth and all her beings. Our tendency towards autonomous anti-colonial struggles that intervene and attack the critical infrastructure that the U.S. and its institutions rest on. Interestingly enough, these are the areas of our homelands under greatest threat by resource colonialism. This is where the system is most prone to rupture. It's the fragility of colonial power. Our enemies are only as powerful as the infrastructure that sustains them. The brutal result of forced assimilation is that we know our enemies better than they know themselves. What strategies and actions can we devise to make it impossible for the system to govern on stolen land? We aren't advocating for a state-based solution, redwashed European politic, or some other colonial fantasy of utopia. In our rejection of the abstraction of settler colonialism, we don't aim to seize colonial state power, but to abolish it. We seek nothing but total liberation.
Anarchy in the USA. Yeah. All right. But yeah, brings to mind the landlord question. We have, oh yeah, so I want to bring up another other news. The people of the Upper Niger Delta, Nigeria, are renewing their guerrilla campaign against oil companies there. Because if you can imagine the worst possible pollution that oil drilling creates, it's happening in the Upper Niger Delta. And the documentary from Vanguard from like 2011 or something documented what that looks like. Fishing villages where everything dies. Kind of things you see maybe in Captain Planet cartoons.
Right.
Which are in fact real or based in reality.
Yeah.
Only the person who owns it doesn't actually look like a pig, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't really remember that. Police owning too many factories.
Yeah. That's something else that Captain Planet, were police ever involved?
I don't think enforcing? They were.
Yeah, you have the villains polluting or doing their resource extraction.
Right.
Just seemingly for the hell of it.
Well, we do it because we want to.
Yeah, we want to. We're going to make money.
Money is the most important thing in our society.
But, you know, if it was fair and balanced, they would like, well, the stuff I'm going to make is going to make a lot of people happy and create jobs. And that's settler colonialist ideas.
Yeah.
So that's what, just to talk about what that means. When we get back from the break, we will discuss the difference between decolonization with the anti-colonial. So,
okay.
Which is, again, like in a sub-conversation of anarchist stuff. And then, it's just a meme.
Yeah.
And then we'll continue with this discussion of indigenous perspectives of that address the kind of crisis and the questions of, you know, what is looking forward look like? Okay, welcome back to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Michael Walsh in the studio.
Hello.
So, to continue with our the topic of from the last one, which was anarchist indigenous perspective of smash the state. We don't want to take it over. It's the cause of our actual problems. We need alternatives. Just thinking,
yeah.
And the alternative is autonomy, the ability to control our own workplaces, lives, homes. And this requires social transformation as much as anything else.
Yeah.
So to discuss that further, because there are two kind of phrases bandied about in the last article, anti-colonialism and decolonialization.
Mm-hmm.
They could be synonyms, but maybe they're not, especially when it's anarchism is concerned,
right.
or just, you know, left wing. So there's a meme here of kind of what path do you walk? The anti-colonial anarchist versus decolonize.
Right.
So why don't you read the left and I'll do the right. And we'll do it in like poetry beat slam set fashion.
Anti-colonial anarchism or decolonialization. Who are you? An ally?
Relative.
Who are you?
Who am I?
Placelessness.
Rooted in ancestral places.
English.
Reclaiming native language.
Good. Bad white man.
Deconstructing our whiteness.
Resisting colonialization.
Dismantling it.
Eurocentric ideologies.
Reclaiming the indigenous mind.
Settler futures on stolen lands.
Relinquishing those stolen lands.
Revolutionary autonomy.
An indigenous community sovereignty.
Human rights.
Natural rights.
Liberation for oppressed native.
Decolonializing native and the settler.
Perpetuation of anarchism.
The survival of our knowledge.
No nations.
Indigenous nations, clans, and tribes.
no gods.
Diverse spiritual realities. So quite the dichotomy there.
Yeah.
And so one is, you could say one is about the tearing down and also anarchism as a leftist Western ideology.
Right.
Is continuing Western traditions of that and such. It's a reaction to it, and thus it's still in that frame of mind. Meanwhile, decolonizing, centering indigenous perspectives is about following their perspectives or learning from them or intertwining them with ours, which is either difficult or the contradictions are so great that you just can't. And it's more about, but as it is, it's about deconstructing the problematic parts of Western ideology, not throwing out Hegel and whatever.
Right.
But putting it in our context. And that's what deconstruction is good for. Yes. So is there more?
There is a whole article. Many forms of resistance to colonialism and empire are necessary and important, and this poster should not be interpreted as dissuading those forms of solidarity and resistance. Nor should anti-colonial consciousness and decolonialization be thought of as mutually exclusive forms of action. They often coexist as named movements side by side. This poster seeks to point out that they may not be equivalent and that there are some critical differences between the two. Recognizing many attempts of the settlers engaging in this resistance identify as anarchists or dwell in an anti-colonial anarchist fringe, we ask you to consider how the pursuit of an anti-colonial consciousness can still allow settler moves to innocence, diversions and distractions that relieve settlers of feelings of guilt while concentrating the need to give up land, power, and privilege.
Concealing the need to give up.
Anti-colonial action is complete, there is no guarantee that the settler has learned any more about who he is or where he comes from. The inner work to heal the spirit from historic traumas that allow and perpetuate colonization may not be engaged. Decolonization creates the possibility for the settler to become something more, to heal the indigenous identity, story, and spirit, and deconstruct the very source of colonizing thought.
There we go. So it's something we can do together. It isn't just creating this fight / us or them mentality that the right and center have.
Yeah.
And getting them to kind of knock them out of it is obviously a very long haul.
Yeah.
But like I said in the previous hour, just talking to them about these issues and trying to engage their empathy centers is very effective.
Yeah.
And this is from social scientific study. But it takes effort, follow-up, and that requires kind of resources, money, to actually pay to do that labor. It's labor.
Right.
It's emotional labor. Yep. It's social labor that I have been doing mostly for free for the last 10 years. And that's why I kind of limit the amount that I do it, because I value my time.
Right.
And I would refer some kind of, if not social compensation even. So two examples of decolonizing in practice. One is very simple. It was published on Thanksgiving. So it's kind of a, fun things to do around the holiday to decolonize and honor Native peoples. Then in your own home, as you kind of do the holiday that's, created by Lincoln to unite the country after our own Civil War to end slavery. Because of selling our contradictions.
Yeah.
Stories told about the first Thanksgiving often perpetuate harmful stereotypes and racism, no duh. It is important to set the record straight, acknowledge Native peoples, debunk the myths, and show Native Americans as contemporary people with dynamic, thriving cultures, not just stuck in museums. November is National Native American Heritage Month and offers many opportunities to move past one-dimensional representations. Thanksgiving is an opportunity to also go beyond the harmful pilgrims and Indians narrative and focus on common values. Now, the thing about developing and perpetuating culture is that there's social science context, material culture, meaning that culture requires stuff. It requires labor to be able to be done. When you're on the reservation or you're in the poverty trap, you really don't have many opportunities to do culture. When you can, it's consumptive. You do what you can, and it always seems kind of limited, and maybe it's how you get
right
the kind of... So, let's see. Things you can do. Number one, learn the real history. Thanksgiving, like Columbus Day, serves as a reminder of the genocide and violence of Native communities, experienced and continued experience. So learn about Thanksgiving and early colonial history from a Native perspective. It includes a bunch of links. I think learning about King Philip's War would also be really instructive. Watch Captured, 1614. This video details the 1614 kidnapping of 20 Wanapog men from Pawtucks, the Wanapog village that eventually became Plymouth Colony, by European explorers who planned to sell them, and the additional seven Native people taken from Nauset on Cape Cod as slaves in Spain. It is an introductory video for the Captured 1614 exhibit created for Plymouth 400 and the Indian Spiritual and Cultural Training Council. And there's a sub kind of bullet on why treaties matter. The United States have ratified more than 370 treaties with Native American nations, yet many Americans know little about these treaties that shaped and continue to impact the country today.
Yeah.
Probably need your own little doctorate on that.
Yeah.
In honor of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, that was signed September 17th, 1851, between U.S. treaty commissioners and representatives of the Cheyenne, Sioux, Apapacho, Crow, Asparani, Madrin, Stata, and Acara nations, the campaign taps music fans and supporters of indigenous rights. So it was a music fest. Number one. Number two. We're only on number two, fortunately. They're short. They get shorter. Decolonize your dinner. Native chefs have created a culinary movement with the goal of getting indigenous people to honor their ancestors through the dietary choices. Ooh, bring Native American dishes to your dinner table. And then, boom, some recipes.
Ooh, that sounds
number three,
cool.
Listen to indigenous voices. It was the Wanapog people, the people of the first light, that encountered the pilgrims when they arrived in Turtle Island from Europe in 1620. Since 1863, Thanksgiving has been celebrated as a national holiday in the United States, mythologizing the violent events that followed their European arrival into a story of friendship, mutual sharing, important in the Civil War. But the reality is that the Wanapog's generosity was met with genocide. This truth has been suppressed in our education system, government, and pop culture. Listen to an interview by Cedric Cromwell, the tribal council chairman of the Wanapog Tribal Nation in Massachusetts. So it's called We Are Still Here. So it's a talk from him. Stand with the Moshpee. Our land, our people. Hashtag stand with Moshpee. The Moshpee Wanapog tribe are calling on members of Congress to help protect the statue of reservation after the Trump administration overturned an Obama-era decision that could see their land taken from them. This marks the first time that Native land has been taken out of trust, because that's usually how the reservations work, that the land is in trust.
Right.
That is then governed by their local council, which is a little bit tribal communism is called in theory.
Yeah.
To explain what the hell this is. It has been taken out of trust since the termination era of the 40s and 60s, which probably ended a lot of tribal trusts. In the name of progress, I'm sure. Stand with the Moshpee Wanapog tribe by calling your representatives to pass Congress Bill 5244, which reaffirms the Wanapog's reservation. Right. So basically in Massachusetts, I'm supposing that this act by Trump, but it would probably be done by any president, as yeah. Obama would do such, has done that with pipelines, is to privatize the land, take it out of trust so that it is then up for sale. And then... landowners or corporations can then sue the owners of the land and use eminent domain and a bunch of other tactics to acquire it.
Right.
They have many tools in their toolbox. Number five is, of course, celebrate Native people. Listen to their music. Learn how to dance.
Ooh.
Read some Native author works if you have time to read. For many years, Native people were silenced and their stories were marginalized. That's why it's especially important to read stories about Native characters told in Native voices. Celebrate their Heritage Month with a list of books. Available from Audible or whatever else. But there's a magazine called Cultural Survival. Pretty cool. just as you would enjoy any other. It's not appropriation if you just enjoy it, because they're making it. You are enjoying it. Appropriation is taking it and saying, I made this, or I'm doing it, and this is my culture. It's not. You can enjoy it. Buy native-made crafts. You know, support their economy. It's a market economy. Got to earn some cheddar.
Yeah.
So there's a buy native, just as there is a buy local. So it's very similar. Share positive representation of native peoples. Project 562 and Red Works Photography showcase contemporary Native America and Canada with grace, beauty, and style. Nice little art show.
Ooh.
Number 8. And this would be the one that gets into national news the most. End racist native mascots in sports. Because it affects sports.
The Washington football team.
Yes, yes. There are still more than 1,000 high school, university, and professional teams that continue to have Native American mascots. Changes have been made at the high school and college levels in places. At the professional level, there has been virtually no change. Start the change in your community. And this goes with changing any kind of flag. And usually, again, cost is brought up. It costs money to do this. It makes a lot of other material obsolete, you know, which is weird. It's like, oh, now you care about wasting consumptive opportunities that all of your fans would need to buy new merch. I'm sure you make all the money back.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
They buy new uniforms every year, I'm sure.
Right.
Not the case. Yeah, that's the case with high schools and stuff, too. So,
yeah.
So there, that's done. So the other story, which is also pretty short and involves the Keystone XL pipeline in South Dakota, from EcoWatch. Historic first, Nebraska farmers return land to the Ponca tribe in effort to block Keystone XL. This was back in 2018, so 2 years ago, filed by Common Dreams. But it was during like the fallout of it's Trump presidency, but just the continuation of the Obama Democratic policy of we want to be energy independent. We build pipelines so fossil fuel companies can make money to maximize their profits. It's so important they do that, even though as we're doing this rhetoric of we're going to decarbonize, kind of makes it a bunch of hooey.
Yeah.
Filed by Jessica Corbett. In a move that could challenge the proposed path of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline, it acknowledges the U.S. government's long history of abusing Native Americans and forcing them off their land. A Nebraska farm couple has returned a portion of ancestral land to the Ponca tribe. Now, usually a kind of the most hokiest of slogans when it comes to decolonizing or doing something for Native Americans is to say, give back the land. It's something that's never really seems to be taken seriously unless you're a actual left winger.
Right.
Because it's like what it's like reparations.
Yeah.
Something that can be talked about in radical slash serious circles. But when it comes to general conversation, politicians, it's like a joke. Like, what the hell? Like, no. Yeah. Like, well, I mean, hell, just how impossible it is to provide relief during an economic crisis is something that Congress has not done.
Yeah.
They have gone on vacation because they couldn't figure out a deal of some kind. Because, hey, with every $1 billion you give out to working people, you got to basically give $2 billion to corporations. And that's kind of the deal that they've got to work out. Or everybody needs their cut. Instead of making something universal, they have to figure out what groups they're going to give money to and what they won't. But anyway, giving back land. It can be done piece by piece. It can be done just to enlarge the reservations themselves.
I think we should start out with the Great Plains. There's a lot of land and not a lot of people.
Or particularly in each particular state where there are reservations, like there are counties that are emptying out of white people, farmers aging out, farmers that, you know, it's not profitable. It's not, you're not able to operate anymore. And in land that wasn't really good for farming anyway. So why not hand over a whole county over and enlarge the reservation? Sure, there isn't, like, the economic opportunity isn't really growing by doing that since, well, white people are leaving or lower population there because lack of opportunity.
Right.
But land is future opportunity as it is resources and just more to do with. And it also, and if it is economically insignificant, it would still be big symbolic win.
Right.
So at a deed signing ceremony earlier this week, farmers Art and Helen Tendrup transferred to the tribe a 1.6 acre plot of land, so it's not very large, that falls on their own Trail of Tears. Now, as the Omaha World Herald explained, rather than battling the farmers, TransCanada will have to negotiate with a new landowner, one that has special legal status as a tribe.
I got it now, so I can read the next paragraph.
No, you're going to do the other one.
All right, cool.
That's an order. The transfer was celebrated by members of the Pontiac tribe as well as environmental advocates who oppose the construction of the pipeline, as we all should, to continue to demand a local transition, total transition to renewable energy. We want to protect this land, says Larry Wright Jr., chairman of the Pontiac tribe of Nebraska, talking to the World Herald. We don't want to see a pipeline go through, obviously. While TransCanada is trampling on indigenous rights to flatten their bottom line, Native leaders are resisting by building renewable energy solutions like solar panels in the path of the pipeline. Repatriating this land to the Pontiac tribe raises new challenges for the Keystone XL pipeline and respects the leadership of Native nations in the fight against fossil fuel industry, she adds. Tribal sovereignty is central to the movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground and build a more just society for all. Author and 350.org co-founder Bill McKibben called the land transfer an important strategic move while also noting that it is also sacred, as it all is. Thus, to respect it, leave things better than you found them. In recent years, the Tendrups have worked with Pontiac leaders to grow the tribe's sacred corn on the land that has now been returned. The signing ceremony featured the fifth planting of the corn and a performance by their own singers and grass dancers. It's an honor to be here today to celebrate this gracious, generous donation, blah, blah, blah. Pontiac people in this community continue to build strong relationships as they work in collaborative efforts, says Art Tendrup, Norfolk Daily News. It is only fitting that out of the tragedy of the Pontiac Trail of Tears, that a small piece of this historic trail be transferred to them. Daw. So there's their kind of pseudo-fluff, but pseudo-not-fluff at the same time, because this is fighting fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah.
Very radical, very revolutionary to just get back the land. They probably made some kind of arrangements. Maybe they're retiring from the farm life, so they're going to live somewhere else. They got arrangements.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why it took 5 years. But in that five-year period, they did a just transition.
Hey, what else can you do?
Plenty more, but that is a good start.
It's a good start.
And it's certainly what most people are capable of. Okay. So you got the next one open, right?
I do have the next one open. So...
by Mr. Shea, whose name was coming up in a Facebook feed, I think, and I had to think, like, wait, Rainer Shea, I've seen that name before.
Decolonization is crucial for a socialist revolution in the U.S.
Now, let me just stop and review my notes, because I think they're particular. I'll just stop you, and, like, we could skip. There's some paragraphs that are unnecessary.
Okay.
They're just Marxist-Leninist jibber-jabber, if I may be, you know, critical. But there are some paragraphs that are better. Let's see. So go forward, and I might cut you off.
Well, any honest moral reading of the situation in the United States leads one to conclude that decolonization will be essential for creating a just society in the region. And American socialists, in particular, should recognize this fact as they work towards bringing about a revolution in their country.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. They should recognize it because in all of the colonized places where socialist revolutions have happened, decolonization has been a part of the revolutionary process.
Just
Korea
assume.
Didn't have a socialist revolution until it was liberated from Japanese occupation.
Unless it's necessary.
China had to go through the same anti-colonial liberation struggle before it could become socialist. Zimbabwe, which was called Rhodesia before its transition towards a communist African-led government, needed to become decolonized before it could become independent and socialist.
Or independent at all.
The indigenous struggle has also naturally defined the socialist revolutions of Venezuela and Bolivia, and is now shaping the efforts from Bolivia's proletariat to restore the socialist government that a U.S. coup effort recently stole from them. As America's process of class struggle continues and popular interest in socialism grows, we must make decolonization part of the goal that this budgeting anti-capitalist movement desires. To act like the U.S. doesn't need decolonization, to plan to create a socialism with American characteristics, mm-hmm. where socialism is built within a colonial structure, would be to erase the indigenous experience in the same way the capitalists have. If a region has been colonized, there will only be a set right when it's decolonized.
So I want to point out, this is not from an indigenous perspective
right.
at all.
This yeah.
is Rainer Shea, a Marxist-Leninist writer.
Right.
And we're sharing this because it's raises a good point. I mean, it's also from, it would be from where we're standing right now.
Like, yeah.
we want to do this revolutionary process, and doing it within the state, or even like eyeing like we need to take the state power, is just continuing the same problems,
right?
In a way, even if we do a full Green New Deal, let's say. Kind of a thing with the Green Party is like, because of our the last episode's discussion of like half liberal.
Yeah.
That being a party that is then, you know, continuing the system, being a, even from the anarchist point of view, a vote for the Green Party is like a harm reductive strategy, lesser evil type of deal.
Right.
But Howie Hawkins and other socialists in the Green Party have always wanted the Green Party to not really just be electoral, but to be that kind of what the, say, Socialist Alternative says they are, which is the actual grassroots movement-based party that isn't really just about electing people and then those elected people do stuff for the people. No, that's continuing the same old, because you're voting for your autonomy away,
right.
rather than taking it, rather than having control in your life. And as long as we kind of rely on managers and going to the manager to solve our problems and thinking in those terms, instead of taking matters in your own hands or working with others to solve problems, to use that to turn that phrase more.
And the crucial part of supporting decolonization is to understand just what it would entail. Decolonization doesn't merely mean changing symbols or adopting a different mindset or improving policies. It's a transfer of sovereign authority over territory from a colonizing power to the indigenous people of that territory. In the territory that's currently called the United States, there are 562 native tribes, and all of them must have their sovereignty returned to them. Ideally, this American decolonization process would result in these indigenous nations being as governmentally separate from each other as they were before they were invaded. And when Marxism's goal for a withering away of the state is reached within the region, this will be able to happen. But in a world where these tribes will need to collectively fight off the capitalist colonists, they'll need to unite under a kind of indigenous confederacy similar to the one that the native resistor
Temoshe
attempted to create in the middle of the continent after the U.S. was formed. To finish and expand upon Temoshe's project for giving the indigenous people their autonomy, we'll need to wage a militancy even greater than the one he led. This is why any nationwide decolonization project in America will need to interrelate with a proletarian revolution.
Or a class struggle / general strike.
Right. Under capitalism, the state functions as an instrument for enforcing both the hegemony of the bourgeoisie and the continuation of colonialism. In his essay, The State, an Instrument for the Exploitation...
Oh, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah, I'll
stop you there. This is some Leninist stuff.
He just quotes Lenin, literally.
That's a Lenin
essay.
So
we don't really need to do that, but he quotes Lenin, I'll just summarize, and says that a federation of tribes works in tandem with say, our class struggle, whatever form it takes, whether it be blocking evictions, general strike, with the lack of employment, you know, it's like then it becomes an unemployment movement,
right.
of people organizing who are jobless, which is why, like, the whole, like, oh, we can only organize people who are on the job, and through their jobs and work can they make class demands. But that's not true. In Latin America, there have been tons of unemployed men who create a militant movement for, well, unemployment benefits, yeah. let's say, which didn't exist before, by blocking roads. They would block highways every day, burning tires, and it wasn't just a protest, it was an effective blockade. So there's no electoral position to do any of this, and refers to kind of the state of fascism we're currently in. And then he outlines more militant revolutionary tactics. So let's say, if we'll never achieve decolonization, much less socialism of any type, if we try to do it for electoral politics, so just general anti-electoral bent. This has become extremely obvious in the U.S. as it's descended into fascism. To help keep you safe, I've made $600 million worth of surplus military equipment available to law enforcement, Trump said last October. If you remember, the previous administration didn't want to do that. They didn't want to make you look so tough. Even though they distributed all the military vehicles, so that's a lie. And this is the thing about Trump. Everything he says is
some kind of lie.
So this whole, like, trying to debunk or argue with Trump, it's just, like, it's so unnecessary. Just tell your audience that he's lying in some form. Maybe if you want to make it into a lesson about logical fallacies, like Ben Burgess does with Ben Shapiro, do that.
But that actually sounds like a great idea.
But it's not news. It shouldn't be reported as news. It shouldn't be treated as news. They didn't want to make you look so tough, blah, blah, blah. This situation, and echoing the surge, like from the Iraq War, this situation where the U.S.'s empire turns inward, which has been provoked by climate change, economic decline, and our collapse of as a global power. The extreme inequality, this exemplifies capitalism in its decay. To strike the beast down, we must equip ourselves. Now, of course, all of this was kind of said in the 20s and 30s with the Great Depression. So are we all just kind of repeating this great cyclical spiral of progress? Maybe. As far as American history is concerned, you know, we had 40 years of the Gilded Age, which is not represented in American media at all that I'm aware of, unless it's like Robert Barron's History Channel miniseries. So to strike the beast down, we must equip ourselves to overcome the state's instruments of repression by building the institutions for revolt, blah, blah. Making workers armed and trained, which is a big ask, especially for those that are just getting comfortable with being oppositional to power, to the status quo, to actually protest in the street, which is still not a lot of people. A lot of people came out for the big, I support Black Lives Matter.
Right.
But that doesn't, what it stood for was very nebulous and ill-defined. On purpose. People come out for vaguely defined causes.
Yeah.
As soon as, say, the cause then starts saying, defund the police, this is our platform.
Right.
Suddenly a lot of this public support evaporates. At least the loud support, the noisy support. It goes into passive mode. To be mobilized at a later time when the outrage is at its peak. And then just kind of ebbs away again. Because it wasn't organized in the first place. And I worry that the opportunity to organize more is again slipping away. Because it's still falling into the same patterns of activism from the past 40 years. Where cause is being addressed or problem. And then it's addressed half-heartedly or not at all. In the case of, like, well, what reforms are really being proposed?
Right.
What are actually being passed months into the so-called movement? And then it just becomes another kind of interest group.
Right.
The Black Lives Matter interest group. And then it becomes an argument about this interest group. Like the NRA. Is it a danger? Are they criminals? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So the rest of our time, how are you doing on the invites?
I'm good.
Okay.
I've figured out a way to make it so my posts, I get a good, like, about once every couple days, I'll have one that goes fairly viral and gets, like, a couple thousand shares.
Yeah.
And I call those posts, I kind of refer to them as my salt licks, because then I'll go into the invite, and then it's just invite, 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 and then I have to sit there and just manually press invite, like, 100 times, and then I think it's worth it.
There's no box to say invite all.
None that I've found. If there was, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Interesting that it doesn't allow that. another bit of code, just a line of code is probably all it needs. But that's your burning the bear for being so successful. I only maybe have three people to invite to the page now and then.
I've also noticed that if you join a group as the page and then post in the group as the page,
that
all
really
of those
helps.
Likes in the group, I can then invite as well.
That I should probably just be doing that. I keep having this inkling, and I feel uncomfortable being the page in these groups. I'd rather interact as me. I want people to know who I am. I feel like it's uncomfortable to be. It's because it creates a wall of the anonymity,
right?
That creates the toxic behaviors that I, being part of the culture that does the opposite, which is no. Here's my face. Here's something where I'm doing an action.
Right.
I'm being political in my picture, so you know that I'm not just armchair.
Right.
Back off. And so on and so on. The extra thought on the Karen and how so many of us are making posts and things about what we want to happen. We're talking about the leftist discussion pages about how is socialism going to work? What about this in the future? It's like everyone's talking the future tense. Once the revolution happens, once we're in power, how will this work?
The revolution's happening, baby.
But I'm also just none of it's happened yet. And you're trying to figure out how things are going to be in the future. This is that set of colonial ideology.
Yeah.
We got to plan everything out in advance. We have to know how everything's going to work or else I'm not on board.
Right.
And then there's this thing of leftists and other socialists who have to say, I'm not sold on Howie yet. He's a socialist. That's all you should need to know.
Right.
Vote for socialists. At least let's have socialists vote for socialists. If nothing else. And then, we can be represented in the vote count or the so-called vote count.
Right.
And this is the argument I go with when it comes to people and, why vote green in this election. We need to be represented. You're not represented. And this is Howie's line.
Yeah.
Don't get lost in the sauce of the Dems. Because that's what happens when you vote with them. You are literally signing away your sovereignty, your independence, and your ability to actually, because you're voting for Harris. You're fine with all of it. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Because Trump is worse. It could be worse.
It's all orange man bad.
Yeah. Another comment I made was nothing has ever been made better or any progress be made through thinking of it could be worse.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure how this, it could be worse, because, meaning, we're talking about Biden, meaning. There could be a worse Democrat than Biden running.
Once Mitch McConnell becomes a Democrat in 10 years.
Schumer is ads that are showing up on Facebook. It's Schumer saying I just want you to answer one question for 538 Nate Silver's site. Do you approve of Mitch McConnell? It's then you can give us money to elect the six Democratic blue dog senators that will not pass anything, but will have control of the Senate.
And I was following
that will make you feel good again.
I was following the campaign for the guy trying to run against Mitch McConnell, and there was a progressive in that race, and the progressive lost, and now the moderate is very much definitely going to lose to Mitch McConnell.
I remember that reminds me of 2012-08, where you had. It was after 2010, so I guess 2012, 2014, where it seemed you had the Justice Dems and whatever doing this campaign of we'll run progressives in the primaries and we'll slowly change the makeup of the Democratic Congress.
Right.
Utterly failed. They elected the squad and they have their press conferences and their memes.
Right.
But otherwise, what results are there? For our quote-unquote side. The progressives in the Democratic Party are as powerless ever. Yeah. They have to argue about whether or not what the centrists do is good enough for them.
Yeah.
Sad.
It is sad.
So here's something that's a little also kind of sad, but also almost... It's more about recognizing a more uncomfortable truth. That... We can't have this better world we want to have until the crisis comes to a head. Things have to get worse before they can get better.
Right.
I'm not always agreeing with that. I don't put it as my moral philosophy or something, but it's right. It's kind of true in this instance. At least this is the argument of this piece by the same writer who did the voting isn't harm reduction.
Oh yeah.
So now in the same vein of anti-statist, anarchistic kind of framing, but still indigenous perspective, it's Rethinking the Apocalypse, an Indigenous Anti-Futurist Manifesto. So mentioning about how your future utopia is still genocide to us. And that goes for minorities. It goes for us as a species, even. That's why I'm uncomfortable about, even in solarpunk and, we're all about, bottom up, do yourself. There's still, sharing posts about vertical farming.
Right.
That's really energy intensive. And I'm not even sure how it's financially feasible.
Right.
It's just we'll make it work. We could easily, send all of these waste streams to make the vertical farm productive.
Exactly.
And I'm like, yeah, easily. Right. That's a leap. Can we imagine the ending of the world, yet not the ending of colonialism? So same, you could trade out colonialism with capitalism here. We live in the future of a past that is not our own. It is a history, and this is more poetic, by the way, a poetic manifesto. Very bombastic language here. It is a history of utopian fantasies and apocalyptic idealization. It is a pathogenic global social order of imagined futures built on genocide, enslavement, ecocide, total ruination. What conclusions are to be realized in a world constructed of bones and empty metaphors? A world of fetishizing endings calculated amidst the collective fiction of virulent specters, like zombie movies.
Yeah.
From religious tomes to fictionalized scientific entertainment, each imagined timeline, scientific entertainment, that's most documentaries about science and future. Each imagined timeline constructed so predictably, beginning, middle, and ultimately, the end. Inevitably, it is this narrative, linear thinking, that there's a progenic fighting of an enemy other. A generic appropriation of Asian or Haitian spirituality of the zombie. And spoiler alert, it's not you or me. So many are eagerly ready to be the lone survivors of a zombie apocalypse. But these are interchangeable metaphors. The zombie, other, this apocalypse, these empty metaphors, linearity, only exist within the language of nightmares. They were once part of the apocalyptic imagination and impulse, this way of living, culture. It is this very culture that must have always an enemy other to lay blame. A subhuman enemy that any and all forms of extreme violence are not only permitted, but expected to be put upon. If it doesn't have an immediate other, it meticulously constructs one. This other is not made from fear, but its destruction is compelled by it.
They are dirty. They are unsuited for life. They are unable. They are incapable. They are disposable. They are non-believers. They are unworthy. They are made to benefit us. They hate our freedom. They are undocumented. They are queer. They are black. They are indigenous. They are less than. They are against us until finally they are no more. In this constant mantra of violence reframed, it is either you or them. It is the other who is sacrificed for an immoral and cancerous community. It is the other who is poisoned, who is bombed, who is left quietly beneath the rubble. This way of unbeing, which has infected all aspects of our lives, which is responsible for the annihilation of entire species, the toxification of oceans, air, and earth, the clear-cutting and burning of whole forests, mass incarceration, the technological possibility of world-ending warfare, and rising the temperatures on a global scale, this is the deadly politics of capitalism. It's pandemic.
So the quote underneath is, "Dear colonizer, your future is over." And so the meaning of the last paragraph is that our status quo has no future.
Yeah.
It will change. Rather, things will change in order for there to be a new status quo. What that change is something that we can shape in our day-to-day yearly activities. That's kind of the general practice. And so we don't feel hopeless going day to day.
Right.
Otherwise, Matt Crispin points out, when the dystopia comes, Tuesday will still be a Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's just a slog, when you're mining the slurry out of the mines or something. or you're some kind of cyberpunk slave of some kind. There'll still be a Tuesday.
Yeah, working under Lord Bezos,
right,
in the kingdom of Amazonia.
But ultimately, it will destroy itself.
Right.
So we accept that, and then we can actually kind of move beyond it. Waiting for the end, let's say. Waiting for it. Just waiting.
The physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual invasion of our lands, bodies, and minds to settle and to exploit is colonialism. Ships sailed on poisoned winds and bloodied tides across oceans pushed with shallow breath.
Oh, and actually, can you stop there and skip ahead to our ancestors dreamt against the end of the world?
Yeah. Our ancestors dreamt against the end of the world. Many worlds have gone before this one. Our traditional histories are tightly woven with the fabric of birthing and ending of worlds. Through these cataclysms, we have gained many lessons that have shaped who we are and how we are to be with one another. Our ways of being informed through finding harmony through and from the destruction of worlds, the elliptic birth, death, rebirth. We have an unknowing of histories upon histories of the world that is a part of us. It is the language of the cosmos. It speaks in prophecies long carved in the scars where our ancestors dreamed. It is the ghost dance, the seven fires, the birth of the white buffalo, the seventh generation. It is the five suns. It is written in stone near a rabbi and beyond. These prophecies are not just predictive. They also have been a diagnostic and instructive. We are the dreamers dreamt by our ancestors. We have traversed all time between the breaths of our dreams. We exist at once with our ancestors in unbirthed generations. Our future was held in our hands. It is our mutuality, our interdependence. It is our relative. It is in the creases of our memories, folded gently by our ancestors. It is our collective dream time, and it is now, then, tomorrow, yesterday. The anti-colonial imagination isn't a subjective reaction to colonial futurisms. It is an anti-settler future. Our life cycles are not linear. Our future exists without time. It is a dream, uncolonized. We are not concerned with how our enemies name their dead world, or how they recognize or acknowledge us or these lands. We are not concerned with reworking our ways of managing control or honoring their dead agreements or treaties. They will not be compelled to end the destruction that the world is predicated on. We do not plead with them to end global warming, as it is the conclusion of their apocalyptic imperative, and their life is built upon the death of Mother Earth. We bury the right wing and the left wing together in the earth they are so hungry to consume. The conclusion of the ideological war of colonial politics is that the indigenous peoples always lose, unless we are ourselves. Capitalists and colonizers will not lead us out of their dead futures. Apocalyptic idealization is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is the linear world ending from within. Apocalyptic logic exists within a spiritual, mental, and emotional dead zone that also cannibalizes itself. It is the dead risen to consume all life. Our world lives when their world ceases to exist. As indigenous anti-futurists, we are the consequence of the history of the colonizer's future. We are the consequence of their war against Mother Earth. We will not allow the specter of the colonizer, the ghosts of the past, to haunt the ruins of the world. We are actualization of our prophecies. This is the reemergence of the world of cycles. This is our ceremony. Between silent skies, the world breathes again and the fever subsides. The land is quiet, waiting for us to listen. When there are less distractions, we go to the place where our ancestors emerged. And their/our voice. There is a song older than worlds here. It heals deeper than the colonizer's blade could ever cut. And there, our voice, we were always healers. This is the first medicine. Colonialism is a plague. Capitalism is pandemic. These systems are anti-life. They will not be compelled to cure themselves. We will not allow these corrupted, sickened systems to recuperate. We will spread. We are the antibodies.
Pretty cool reading. Two ideas being kind of held simultaneously to me, which are that Western Civ is obsessed with apocalypse.
Yeah.
Linear thinking that we will have an apocalypse. Even at the same time, we have our own subcultures that are obsessed with things continuing the same as they are forever. This is the newness of neoliberalism, I suppose. End of history stuff. At the same time, there's kind of the thought that, like, as you said, like, our world can live again. The world can live again when this dies. When it kills itself, when there is the apocalypse. Well, really, the message here is that there is no such thing as apocalypse. Get that idea framing out of your head. Even as climate change racks our infrastructure and is chaotic, it's still not the apocalypse. Life will continue in one way or another. I'm reminded of the thing, there was a George Carlin joke about, like, you know, world will shake us off like a case of fleas. But also, that's more cynical, because human life will also continue, but in vastly different ways. And we should be comfortable with that, and not mourn it, but accept it. And then maybe we can then move forward with making our world better and kind of be more honest about what the problems really are and how total they are, as far as like what needs to really transform and how far we take it, and that we should have the courage to do that. So that, any party thoughts?
I like the general message.
Thank you. This is the Three Left Show. We are found on Facebook, Three Left Show, and Twitter. Full archive of episodes is found at threelefts.news, www.threelefts.news. There is a Patreon page as well if you'd like to support us materially. I also want to shout out that we are going to have our membership drive very soon, or at least it's ongoing. Please become a member of WCAALP Albany. Go to the site grandstreetarts.org to help us sustainably fund, or rather be a patron of, this community-run radio station that provides vast amounts of creative and unique content that acts local, thinks global.
Check out my social media too. I'm the Homegrown Socialist, and I'm on all of the platforms at HG Socialist.
And with that, that's the end of the episode.